Well, this morning in the church lectionary, it's Transfiguration Sunday, which sits right in between the season of Epiphany and the season of Lent, which we're about to enter. And it's in this transition that the disciples get a glimpse of Jesus's divinity, in which he undergoes a mystical change on the top of a mountain and becomes this indescribable sight. This moment of change is also meant to invite the disciples into their own journey of transformation. So before we jump in, why don't you reflect on this question at home? When was a time you experienced a noticeable change? Right? What did that feel like for you? And so I'll give you a moment to reflect on that at home, and feel free to offer any of your thoughts on the live chat as well. So clearly, I have undergone a noticeable change since last week when I was on screen. But if we go back even further to more than a year ago, January 2020. So this is a picture of my pre-pandemic hair. And then the pandemic hit, and I didn't cut my hair for over a year. And so here's a picture of my pandemic hair in all its full glory as of this past week. And that was a gradual change that took over a year. And this change took less than 30 minutes, which, by the way, feels amazing not to have hair everywhere. But for the disciples in the text we'll be looking at today, they see Jesus change in a way they never expected or could imagine. Right? They get a glimpse of Jesus in his divinity, which in a way validated what he had been teaching the disciples and what his work was here on earth. And by revealing this glimpse to the disciples, he was also inviting them into the work of change and transformation for themselves and the world. Now, this is how Desmond Tutu describes our invitation in Transfiguration. He says, "God places us in the world as fellow workers, agents of transfiguration. We work with God so that injustice is transfigured into justice, so there will be more compassion and caring, that there will be more laughter and joy, that there will be more togetherness in God's world." And so this morning, the question I want to reflect on is, how does Jesus's transfiguration invite us to transformation and change as we enter this season of Lent? And in our text, we'll see that the transfiguration interrupts and disrupts what the disciples imagined and expected of Jesus. They're given an invitation to change and be transformed with this new realization and understanding of who Jesus is and what he's called them to do. And so we start in verse 2. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. And then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And so here's a central moment in Jesus' life. And even symbolically, it's located in the center of Mark's gospel. And it serves as a moment of transition from one act of Jesus' story to the next act. And this description of Jesus being transfigured doesn't do it full justice, since it was probably indescribable with words. And this was the best Mark could offer in describing Jesus's divine appearance. I mean, he was trying to capture the merging of the temporal and eternal worlds in this moment, right? Because Moses and Elijah are also making an appearance. And there's a couple of reactions that we see here from Peter, right? First, there's obviously confusion and fear, because it was probably terrifying to witness this up close and in person. And then second, he tries to make some sense of this experience and what it all means. You know, instead of just being in the wonder and mystery of it, he's trying to contain it and fit it in his own box by offering to build literal dwellings to capture and define this moment, which is indescribable. And yes, there was probably a spirit of hospitality or, you know, a desire for remembrance or even a reference to the Feast of Booths by offering to build these dwellings. But at the same time, even though he witnessed something transcendent, Peter was still looking for a way to somehow contain it, to capture this moment in a way to define what it means to encounter God. And for us, though, transformation invites us to expand our containers for God. Because at the heart of transformation, we can't change how we relate with God if we simply default to the boxes that we have put God in. You know, recently, my youngest daughter, Clementine, was working on some math problems where you multiply double-digit numbers, and I was helping her check her work. And I was showing her how to work through the problem. And I started doing what, you know, I've done since I was a kid and probably what most all of you do, right? You multiply the top numbers with the bottom right one, and then you drop a zero and then multiply the top numbers with the bottom left one. And then you add those two totals together. But she said, no, that's not how you're supposed to do it. And I was like, no, this is how you multiply double digit numbers. And she kept insisting that's not what her teacher taught them. Apparently they use the box method or the area method, which, you know, you draw it out, which looks crazy to me, but you know what? It works. And it blew my mind. And I have to admit, in that moment, my fourth grade daughter expanded my own limited container of multiplication, right? There's clearly more than I thought in the world of double digit multiplication. There's a book by Lauren Winner called Wearing God. And she talks about the different images of God that haven't been given as much attention. This is what she says. Unlike my church, with its four favored metaphors, the Bible offers hundreds of images of God. Images the church has paid a great deal of attention to in earlier centuries, although many are largely overlooked now. Beekeeper, homeless man, tree. Shepherd and light are perfectly wonderful images, but in fixing on them, in fixing on any three or four primary metaphors for God, we have truncated our relationship with the divine, and we have cut ourselves off from the more voluble and variable witness of the scriptures, which depict God as clothing, as fire, as comedian, sleeper, water, dog. She's saying that when we limit our images of God, we're also limiting our ability to connect and relate with God more fully. We're limiting our ability to be transformed if we don't expand our containers for God. And for us, what have been our primary metaphors and images for God? Right? In your mind, what names and images do you automatically default to? Maybe a practice we can try this week is to expand the symbols we use for God, whether it's the words we use or the images we reflect on. Right? Try using a word or image that you haven't used before in referring to and connecting with God. And as we focus on a different image this week, consider how it might expand the container that we've put God inside and allow us to see and experience God more fully. And then we continue in verse 7. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. And if this sounds familiar, this is a callback to the baptism of Jesus in Mark chapter 1, which we reflected on at the beginning of Epiphany. And in his baptism, there was also a voice in the clouds, which was directed at Jesus, where God said, "You are my son, the beloved. With you, I am well pleased." And this is even before Jesus had done anything yet. God was communicating love that isn't based on accomplishment or achievement. You know, there's tenderness in God's voice. I imagine God smiling while expressing how Jesus is beloved. And here at the Transfiguration, God's voice was directed to everyone who was present, including the disciples, telling them that this is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. And so for us, transformation is an invitation to listen to Jesus, to listen to his teachings, his words, and his actions, to listen to his life. And there's a big difference in simply hearing Jesus and actually listening. I mean, all of us can hear without listening, because listening implies intentionality, an active posture where we seek to understand and integrate what we've heard. It's what Judy talked about last Sunday. You know, how do we know if we're actually listening to the words of Jesus? By whether or not we embody the words of Jesus. And why would God need to explicitly remind the disciples to listen to him? Right? Isn't that assumed? Isn't that the reason why they're following him in the first place? But if we look at the passage right before this text and the passage right after this text, we find two examples where Jesus tells his disciples about his own future suffering and upcoming death, and the disciples just don't get it. In fact, in one instance, Peter actually pushes back against those words, and Jesus calls him Satan, which pretty much ends the conversation right there. But they don't understand because they're not really listening and discerning the words that Jesus is telling them. And throughout the Gospels, we see the disciples continuously misunderstand and sometimes completely miss Jesus' intentions and motivations behind what he was telling them, because it didn't line up with what they expected Jesus should be and what he should do. They expected power and a revolutionary takeover. And Jesus was talking about sacrifice and giving up your life. You know, for me, there's a continuing dissonance in the Christian nationalism that keeps rearing its ugly head, especially over the last 4 years. And it was on display at the Capitol riots last month. You know, seeing flags and banners that said Jesus 2020 or Jesus Saves in the heart of the crowds of rioters was so jarring and angry to witness. That there's such a complete disconnect between what they think Jesus represents and what Jesus actually taught and modeled. And the question I desperately want to ask them is, you know, who and what are you listening to? Is there something that you so desperately want Jesus to be and do that you misunderstand or choose to ignore what he actually taught and modeled? But that question can easily be reflected back to me. Right? In what ways has my own bias created an assumption of who Jesus should be and what he should do? Even for myself in my journey of faith and transformation, I'm still invited to go back to listen to Jesus and consider and discern how I actually practice and embody his words and actions. Right? How might that actually change us if we keep asking ourselves whether or not we're listening to Jesus? And if we're not, what are the voices, influences, and words that are taking up space in our ears and minds and hearts? And for us, maybe a practice we can try this week and through the season of Lent is to spend some time reading through the Gospels again. And as we read through the teachings and life of Jesus, pay attention to how we're receiving his words and actions. Sometimes it helps to access it in a different way. So maybe read a different translation than you normally read, or actually listen to it through an app. You know, if you need a starting place, try the Sermon on the Mount, in the book of Matthew to listen to. Jesus offers some very practical teaching there. And in our listening, begin to wrestle with and discern how to embody his words, actions, and life. And then a cloud overshadowed them. And from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." And then we close in verse 9. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. And we end this scene with the return back down the mountain, which is such an important part of Jesus' journey. The goal wasn't for him to stay in this transfigured form on a mountaintop. It wasn't for the disciples to stay up there soaking in Jesus in his full divinity. What stands out in this experience is that Jesus came back down to where the rest of the disciples were, down to the challenges and discomfort of real life, down to the constant bickering between the disciples about who's more important, which literally happens later in the same chapter. And ultimately for Jesus coming back down to where crucifixion was awaiting. And that's what really makes this moment and experience so striking, right? It starts with ascending up to the top of this mountain where we see this incredible moment that's spectacular and indescribable. And it's meant to capture the wholeness of who Jesus is in his divinity. And then at the same time, there's also a descent down the mountain where he's about to enter into great suffering and pain and brokenness. It's an image of paradox, seeing those two things side by side. And for us, transformation is an invitation to sit in the paradox of both wholeness and woundedness. Sometimes it might look like Jesus' experience, where an encounter of wholeness prepares us for an encounter of woundedness. Sometimes it's woundedness that leads us and opens us up to wholeness. And sometimes it can be simultaneous. But how are we invited to sit in this paradox of wholeness and woundedness in our current life? How might things need to be cut off and dissected in order for wholeness and new life to surface? You know, last weekend, I had the opportunity to attend the story workshop for racial trauma and healing, which was offered by the Allender Center, where Sam Lee is heavily involved. And I'm grateful for the space that was specifically shaped for the BIPOC community and offering us an opportunity to share and process our experience as minorities in this country. And to hear the stories of those in our Black and Indigenous communities, in our Asian American communities, in our Latinx communities, I mean, it was such a vulnerable invitation into the wounds and pain and confusion that we have collectively navigated in majority white culture. You know, my story has been one of deep assimilation into whiteness. You know, growing up wishing I had a more white name, wishing my skin was less dark. And something one of the facilitators offered that's continued to stay with me is, how have I had to dissect parts off of who I am in order to fit into majority white culture? What has been the cost for my own assimilation? Because honestly, I haven't considered that cost for myself. I was so focused on blending in and living into the myth of the model minority that I didn't think it was costing me anything as long as I was able to fit in. But there are parts of me that haven't been able to experience and express themselves in the wholeness of who God made me to be. And if I'm to enter into a journey of healing towards that wholeness, there might be a cost to that as well. Because there are parts of my ethnic identity that I've tried to hide and protect because I didn't want to experience woundedness. And as encouraging and life-giving as last weekend was for me, My invitation is to continue to be present and come back down from the mountain, to come down from avoidance, to come down from silence, to come down from false safety, and to be present here in the space I currently inhabit and live. To continue to do the work of transformation in my life that exists in the paradox of wholeness and woundedness. And for each of us, I mean, what are the stories and experiences of woundedness that have existed on the same path that also lead to wholeness? And how are we invited to come down from whatever mountain we've climbed, thinking we might find wholeness at the top? This is how John O'Donohue beautifully captures this paradox. He says, the beauty that emerges from woundedness is a beauty infused with feeling, a beauty different from the beauty of landscape and the cold, perfect form. This is a beauty that has suffered its way through the ache of desolation until the words or music emerged to equal the hunger and desperation at its heart. It must also be said that not all woundedness succeeds in finding its way through to beauty of form. Most woundedness remains hidden, lost inside forgotten silence. Indeed, in every life, there's some wound that continues to weep secretly, even after years of attempted healing. But where woundedness can be refined into beauty, a wonderful transfiguration takes place. And so, Vox, my hope and prayer for us as we transition into the season of Lent is that we would engage and interact with Jesus in a way that moves us to transformation, both for ourselves and for our world. And so let me close with this prayer for us. So, Vox, may our eyes expand our vision and imagination to see God beyond our limited containers. May our ears listen and not just hear the words and life of Jesus, that they may become embodied. And may our bodies sit and be in the paradox of wholeness and woundedness to experience transformation in love. So we ask all this in the mystery of the Father, the woundedness of the Son, and the transformation of the Spirit. Amen.